What am I saying at the beginning of this one? What am I saying on any of this?
You're not. There's a scrolling thing that just comes down. People have to actually listen to that.
Dear listener, and welcome back to Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast coming to you live through the amplified panatropic computer net, which, as we all know, is made of a series of tubes and cats. I'm Brendan.
I'm Nathan.
And I'm Todd.
And we are here today to discuss The Deadly Assassin. What other kind of bloody assassin is there?
I hate that title.
There's a deadly assassin or there's a crap one.
Correct, Brendan.
I think Bob Holmes in an interview later did actually say that there are incompetent assassins, so
yeah,
it's not quite a tautology. It is better than The Dangerous Assassin.
Yeah, which was the working title.
I don't care. It's the beginning of my irritation with many aspects of this story.
And thankfully, it's mine. I want to start off with one of the criticisms that's been levelled at this story. For those of you who haven't seen The Deadly Assassin, probably a good idea for you to watch it first. So we have the first story completely set on the planet of the Time Lords, which we now know is Gallifrey. We had, of course, previously seen the planet of the Time Lords in the War Games, last episode of the War Games, and also intermittently in The Three Doctors. But this is the first story entirely set there. Now, what a lot of fans say about this story is that it changes what we know about the Time Lords. It presents them as a very insular, very stagnated society. Sort of, there's lots of ornate people in robes flowing about and being quite ineffectual. Really, it was first posited in an issue of the Celestial Toy Room in an article by then-President Jan Vincent Rudzki, who also appears on the DVD for The Deadly Assassin on the making of, giving his reaction to the story. Personally, I don't see a problem with presenting the Time Lords in this way, because what we have been previously told about the Time Lords, and what is even further defined here, is that the Time Lords are an insular, isolationist society. And remember, part of the reason that the Doctor was an outcast is because he went out into the universe, which they're not meant to be allowed to do. And the Doctor's already said, as when he was Patrick Troughton, you know, he's quite bored by the Time Lords. And a homogenous, isolationist culture would stagnate.
I think that Holmes, more than anyone else, defines the Doctor against the forces of rules and bureaucracy and staleness. Mm-hmm. You know, as early as the Crotons have the procedure that has to be obeyed. And I think it's Holmes that pins that down as the thing that the Doctor is opposed to.
Yeah.
And so naturally, when he gets his go at creating the Time Lords, they're hidebound and stuffy and tied down by procedure. So I guess it's natural that that's his take on the Time Lords rather than, you know, the game show hosts of the Three Doctors or the incredibly terrifying and powerful, you know, Terence Dix version of the Time Lords in the War Games.
Yeah. I don't think it's irreconcilable with either of those two examples. And I think Robert Holmes actually takes a little bit of care with that, you know, because when we've seen the Time Lords before, we've just sort of briefly flashed to their planet and just seen a little bit of it. And it's kind of like when you get a program like, say, House of Cards or The West Wing, when you see President Bartlett delivering a speech, it's very different to when he's in the Oval Office discussing something with a member of his staff. You know, what we're seeing in this story is behind the scenes of the Time Lords. And that's something I quite like about it. But I just wanted to get that out of the way first, because it's one of the big talking points about this story, and we'll certainly come back to it over the course of our podcast today.
In fact, nearly every, I think, modern assessment of this story is a reaction to the review that you mentioned.
Yeah.
Because the review goes into sort of into great detail about the fact that there's been all of this complicated information given over the course of the program about the Time Lords, and this just flagrantly contradicts it. And where is the magic of Doctor Who? If you haven't read this review, I couldn't find the text online, but I did find a YouTube video of a CG character saying saying the text. So I'll put a link in the show notes, and it's in License Denied, which was a collection of fan writing that Paul Cornell put together. And no one has been very interested in presenting a coherent picture of the Time Lords, and that's not what Doctor Who does. No, I mean, you kind of think they've not been watching the same program. There's no coherent picture of the Daleks or the Cybermen or units or really anything at all. The show, it's not Star Trek, do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
It's Doctor Who, and so things just change from
production team. You see, I don't have a love for this, and it's because I don't have a connection to it. It was not part of my childhood. We didn't get to see this. And so my Gallifrey is the Gallifrey from Invasion of Time. That's my Barusa. That's my Castellan. That's my Gallifrey. That's my set. So when I come to this, I come to it with that baggage and that look to it. So I don't necessarily warm to a lot of what is presented and how it's presented here. I don't have a problem with defining of the Time Lords and all that. It's more to do with what's the characters and how they're played and that sort of thing.
It's a weird experience, isn't it? I had exactly the same experience. So we would go straight from The Hand of Fear to Face of Evil.
That's right.
Which still works.
And then when we came a year later to The Invasion of Time, were you aware, Todd, that it was like a sequel to an adventure that we hadn't seen at the time?
I didn't know that there was this other thing. It never existed. Like, it just was. I didn't know that there was this story in there.
Because when you watch it now, of course, it's full of references, isn't it, to The Deadly Assassin.
If we look at the plot, it's got a very interesting opening with the Doctor receiving the vision, you know, of being the assassin. That is very effective and very striking. And, of course, people kind of reference the Manchurian Candidate, and certainly there was an influence there.
It hasn't been done in Doctor Who before, so I give it those points.
Absolutely.
So what was the call home that he received at the end of Hand of Fear?
I believe that's sent from the Master.
Yes, exactly. The Master's bringing him there to frame him.
Okay.
Yeah. So, spoiler alert, dear listener, the Master's in this one.
you know, it starts and you've got the scrolling text that Star Wars would do year later, so I have to give them points for that. But I come into this having had the Star Wars experience, so it's sort of like, well, I've seen that before, right? So that's the first thing that sort of doesn't quite sit the best with me. Right?
And also, it's like, what is the background of that shot? It's a wall with some dry ice over the top of it. It's a little bit weird, that shot. I still like it because it tells you that this story is going to be unusual. Mm. And of course, we have no Sarah Jane, Leela hasn't arrived yet, so in a way there's no companion, but in a way there is, because of course Philip Hinchcliffe and Robert Holmes didn't really want to do a story without a companion. It was Tom's demand.
So Tom demanded this.
Yes.
And so they decided to do this to prove to him that it couldn't work.
Yeah.
What a great premise for a story. Let's prove to you that it's not going to work.
By doing a story that doesn't work.
But wait. So we could have had four more episodes of Sarah Jane Smith and then gone straight into Leela, possibly. So that irritates me. I'm just going to preface it to the listeners. There's a lot of illogical things that I'm going to say here that irritate me about this story, but it's my personal experience of it. So I'm just saying there's little things that begin to just etch away at my enjoyment of this. But please, continue.
I would argue, first of all, that there are companions in this story. There's Spandrel and Engen. I mean, for God's sake, Engen is practically a Doctor Who companion. He asks lots of questions like, oh, what's that, Doctor? And how does that work, Doctor? And what should I do, Doctor?
Engen's the doddery one that's about to collapse dead.
Engen's wonderful.
Fantastic. It's probably my favourite thing in this story.
I love how the Doctor says goodbye to him. You know, he says goodbye, Doctor, and the Doctor's, goodbye, Engen!
it's so good. And, of course, we've got George Pravda back as Spandrel. He's far, far better in this than he was in The Mutants.
Engen was in The Massacre, can I just say.
Yes.
He has that going for
him. Yeah, it was a plot device in The Massacre, that's right.
Okay. There are positive things and there are negative things about Spandrel. I love the way Spandrel's written in terms of he's this policeman, but He's not just gunning for the Doctor. He's willing to listen and investigate. I do have a problem with the performance. The performance works in this context, but the way he delivers his lines is like it's a cold read of the script. I do community theatre, and it's like when you do a cold read of the play to begin with, like whatever you're in, and it's like he's reading it without the commas, without the full stops, without the expression. He just runs his lines into each other, and after a while, like sometimes it works really well, like I really like that, and other times I'm just there going, oh, for God's sake, take a breath. Take a breath. No, I want some expression there. Please stop. So there are parts of this where it just begins to chip away at my enjoyment and just begins to irritate me slightly. Continue, Brendan.
See, I view that performance as being like a sort of hard-boiled American TV detective, you know, just the facts, ma'am, kind of thing. But no, I see where you're coming from with that. And in quite a bit of his acting, George Pravda can sometimes have a sort of monotone delivery, but I think he's very good in
it. I'm not saying it's a bad performance. I'm just saying there's aspects of it that begin to irritate me.
So the Doctor gets recalled to Gallifrey. He has this vision of himself killing the President, but he takes it, from what we can see as the viewer, he fires the gun, the President falls down dead. Now that's shocking enough, the idea, A, that the Doctor would fire a gun, because we've just been told three stories previously that he may carry a gun, but he wouldn't fire it. And we find that out in The Seeds of Doom. So we see the Doctor firing a gun, oh my God. We see him killing someone, oh my God. But then he starts saying, I must get past them and warn the President. So we're like, hold on, what's he... And this is where the Manchurian Candidate influence comes in. Manchurian Candidate being a novel, later a film, about American soldiers being captured and brainwashed as prisoners of war to then go back to America and assassinate political targets.
Think of that episode where Geordi was brainwashed by the Romulans into killing that guy.
Yes, yes. I believe that's one of two episodes where Geordi wears a beard. We get lots of faffing about from Tom and getting into robes and whatnot, which Tom loved, of course, because like all classic doctors, he thought about being a priest or a monk at one point.
No, it was a rule.
Yeah, it was it was actually a rule. It was part of the interview. Did you ever consider being a priest or a monk? Okay, sorry, Richard Griffiths, you can't be Doctor Who. And then we get characters like Runcible the Fatuous.
Who is that? Has he been in Doctor Who before?
He will be in Doctor Who
he
again.
He will be in again.
Yeah.
He's so revelation.
He's the one...
He's the reporter.
The newscast.
Okay, so...
We have the heliotrope of the Patrexies and so on.
Can I just... I just want to bring up a few things there. Obviously, so as a plot device, we're doing the whole reporter BBC Three thing that we've seen before, but this time in terms of Gallifrey because the Doctor has got no companion.
Yeah.
And so that we've then got all the different colours of the academies. And I actually think J.K. Rowling must have been watching this. No, honestly, because she can go, well, we've got Slytherin and obviously Draco Malfoy is going to be goth. We've got the Doctor as Harry Potter. We've got, oh, this one that we must not speak of that's been erased, the Master, who must be there for Voldemort. So, you know what? I think Bob Holmes' estate may have some sort of, you know, claim on the whole thing. Anyway, yeah, that's my bit of it.
If he didn't nick so much from everywhere else,
that's
anyway.
True. Now, of course, then, going back to it, so the Doctor watches Runcible on the monitor.
Yep.
And he's got to get out of the TARDIS.
Yes, and, okay, Todd, I'm going to just throw to you because I know this is a point.
I loathe this. I just think it's so convenient that for this season we've got a black void at the door, so the Doctor can hide on one side of the black void, the guards can come in, and then he can sneak across the other side to get out of the actual TARDIS. It just irritates me. It's not logical, but it just irritates me. I know it has to happen, right? But it irritates me.
This is going to be your refrain this episode. We're going to learn a lot about your psychology, I think, probably.
Not only that, but the Doctor has a hooker in the TARDIS.
Oh, with an AH, right?
With an AH, yeah. That's correct.
What's an AH?
A water pipe.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, the Doctor gets away. He goes around, he yomps around in the Time Lord robes. He has that wonderful conversation with Runcible where Runcible says, weren't you expelled or something? Some kind of
That's good.
In fact, Runcible's the only person he really interacts with in the entire story. So it is most... Not in the entire story. That's a crazy thing.
In this first episode.
In this first episode.
Yeah.
And so it is just basically a chase as Tom sort of, you know, evades everyone.
Mm.
And then world building. So we get to meet all of the main characters and find out what the Time Lord's planet is like.
Yeah, and you get that wonderful line where Commander Hildred reports to Spandrel that the Doctor's gotten away, and Spandrel sums it up something like, so, let me get this straight. You went into his TARDIS and he managed to slip out without you seeing him, and then you only trapped him in a building with 50 floors. Excellent, Hildred. I think you are trying to confuse him.
He's really mean to Hildred all the way through.
But he's deserved so, because Hildred's inept. He's such a wet fish, and quite frankly, I did not cry when he got turned into a toy at the end.
No,
again,
no, exactly.
Hildred is not my commander
in Gallifrey.
It's
yeah,
Andred, who
it's
I think Andred. Is, yeah. who I adore, mm. right? This Castellan is not my Castellan, although I really love him. I like Mr. Slime in Invasion of Time. And, of course, there's another character that occurs in both of these stories,
Barusa.
And that's Barusa.
Barusa. I really like the Barusa in this story. And, of course, his first appearance, he just utterly destroys Runcible. Like, you didn't listen to me at school, why should I talk to you
That's
now?
That's terrific.
It's the dream of every teacher to say that to a student.
Can I just say, the performance is great, the character is great. I like the second Barusa because that was my Barusa as a kid.
Completely understand.
The other problem I have with it is I kind of think, sometimes I go through casting different shows in Doctor Who. Who would I cast in my life? Who would I be cast as? And I kind of look at his performance and the way he talks, and I just kind of think, I can't watch myself in a performance, and that's who I see.
Oh,
and so I
right.
just have this sort of, I can't watch him, I just can't watch him. It's just too sort of like, is this how I appear when I'm in class or whatever like that? So that's my slight irritation with that character. And it's not logical, no. It just is.
Do you wear the eye makeup in class, that the lippy and eye makeup that the Time Lords are for some reason affecting in this story?
Dear listener, I just walked into that. There's a reason why I have to have a break every season.
Why do they do that?
Why do they have the makeup?
Why didn't they put Timothy Dalton in that makeup in the end of time? That would have been great.
It's slightly silvery, isn't it?
Yeah.
Talk amongst yourselves. I'm just thinking of Timothy Dalton.
Look, it's a good. I think he's a good Barusa.
Yeah.
And it's another good aspect to the story.
Of the main cast, I don't think there's a weak performance. I think Peter Pratt, when he appears as the Master, is really up against it because he's got to talk through that mask. But I think he's got a wonderful voice and he gets as much expression into the mask and moving it as much as he can. But we're at the end of episode one now, and the cliffhanger is also like the third scene of the episode, which kind of breaks the Doctor Who format, and we see the Doctor gun down the President. It's less of a cliffhanger of how is the Doctor going to get out of this one, and more of a cliffhanger of what did I just see, what did I just happen. Now, in my opinion, the story begins to go downhill from here.
They cheat. The Reprise cheats outrageously.
The Reprise cheats outrageously. The Doctor reveals...
But they insert a scene. So you actually have someone pulling a gun in the crowd, and then the Doctor shoots. And so now we know the only reason
Do
why...
Do we actually see that? Mm. Oh, okay. I'd never know to see that.
Why would you logically put yourself in that position? I'm going to run ahead of all the guards and go up there and pull out this gun, you know?
Yeah.
It just
why not stay in the crowd and say, he's got a gun?
It just irritates me. We wouldn't have a story.
Yeah.
But it irritates me.
Not only that, but a few minutes later, you know what? Great, we've got Bernard Horsfall back. Long-time collaborator with director David Maloney. Mm-hmm. Bernard Horsfall, or British Jack Thompson, if you prefer, mm-hmm. as Chancellor Goth. And Goth says, the President died without naming his successor. We must have an election within 48 hours. And it just leads me to think, A, if you've got a President, he should probably, when he retires, be replaced by an elected official rather than naming his own successor. Secondly, okay, what happens after 48 hours if you haven't had an election? And he starts going on about, oh, you know, other races will be watching and will be weak. It's like, really? Who's watching? Who? I don't understand. You know, we've had this big thing about you're isolationists and you don't interfere with other people and you've got this massive shield around your planet and no one can get in and blah, 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 blah. but your president is killed, and it's okay, you're not prepared for that because you're this isolationist ideal society. Okay, fine. But you don't have any kind of procedure for that that involves catching the assassin and giving him a trial before electing... And why do you have to give the assassin a trial before you elect the president anyway?
Oh, but that, I mean, that's an objection that gets made, isn't it, to Goth, and we find out the reason isn't a political reason, it's because he wants to get the doctor out of the way, and that's the whole purpose of the assassination.
But he seems to have an argument in law, because Barusa and Spandrel kind of accept it and realise they've only got 48 hours.
No, but it isn't, it's explicitly a political decision from Goth, it's not a legal decision. He doesn't have to kill it.
He has law on his side, otherwise he'd be challenged on it. Then we get the whole trial scene, which, to be fair, it's made kind of interesting by the fact that Tom Baker is drawing the Yes Minister titles of all the witnesses in the box.
It's really funny, though. I think it's funny because you've got Runcible and you've got that old guy with the hip.
With the dicky hip. You know?
That's quite fun Holmesian stuff.
You know, I think it is different, mm-hmm. Doctor Who, and I think I see it in retrospect in a lot of movies from the 90s onwards, like having that whole time-lapse sequence with them all presenting, I will criticise it in the fact that, oh, let's just have it in my little room, in my little office, basically. Mm. And that's one of the things I have a problem with this, is that we've got the little tiny octagonal or whatever shape set it is for Spandrel's thing, and then we've got his little office. And then I really don't like the panopticon. It's very, very narrow and small. I never get a sense of the space, and for me, you do get one shot, one wide shot.
There's a couple of long shots with that glass.
Yeah,
and the duplicated extras who wanted to be paid more for being in.
However, I just find the whole thing quite cramped, and for me, for what I wanted Gallifrey to be, I wanted it to be big and expansionist, and I always felt that in the Invasion of Time set, it's actually a much wider and widthier set, and so I'm comparing it to that, which is illogical, but I wanted more from what these sets are giving me.
The whole thing is kind of modelled after, you know, an Oxbridge College or the Vatican or something. And so it needs to look dark and gothic. And I think it does a pretty remarkable job doing that with just plastic walls, green plastic walls.
Well, I really want that it does that, but I wanted to see the outside, you know, like the dome in Castria. Like, I wanted to see that so I could put it into context. Here it's trying to do what it's doing, what we were doing back in the season opener, where we just had the rooms of the Renaissance Italy rather than the whole outside. And I think for me, I don't feel that expanse. That aspect of it just doesn't do it for me.
I think why it was so exciting when we actually saw finally in, was it Sound of Drums, when we saw
Gallifrey. Citadel,
maybe we needed to wait for the technology to catch up, because it does look great when it comes along, I think.
And I can see why it concentrates it on that and it's done like that, you know.
Yeah.
But all the things that I praised in The Mask of Mandragora for doing that and why they did it, I'm not going to praise
you. But Mask of Mandragora did have, you know, like beautiful exterior shots of the palace and that kind of thing, which we don't get anything like here. But I do think, given that the production isn't going to allow them to have a giant big great hall, which is really what you kind of need the Panopticon to be, they do a reasonable job of this. I think the sets, you know, they're pretty good.
Yeah.
Can I think of one thing that I'm really irritated by this story?
You have one thing that you're really irritated by.
Oh, sorry. Another thing. There's no women.
Oh. Yes.
The Time Lords are just all these men.
Mm.
And I just...
There's Helen Blatch.
What does she do?
She reads out the thing about Rassilon. She's the computer voice.
Yeah.
It doesn't count.
No. Well, look, we've complained, and we've been complaining for ages about Philip Hinchcliffe and Bob Holmes' production team not including women, and season 12 was pretty deplorable with its three speaking parts for women, but this is terrible and there's really no excuse for it.
Why couldn't they be there? Why?
Yeah I mean, there's not even any female extras.
No. I think the thing is, and we're going to come up against this again, that Holmes is kind of, you know, because he does literary pastiche and he reaches into the past for the kinds of stories that have been told before, and because he wants to model this on the Vatican and he wants to model it on Oxbridge colleges, which were, the Vatican is still all men, Oxbridge colleges were all men as well. And so for the same reason that things get so sort of, let's use Brendan's word, problematic towards the end of the season, it is because he'll take these literary traditions and just won't bother to fix the problems with them. You know, like, I'm not being a social justice warrior here or anything like that. I'm just bored with all these men. Do you know what I mean? It's dull. And the new series where you will have bunches of women or guest cast that are predominantly women for no particular reason, or even when Saywood comes along or you know, Pennant Roberts later and just starts to put women in for, you know, not for any reason other than they're 50% of the population. You know, things improve, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the new series, when they do historical stories, there is almost always an element of social commentary on how the times have changed. So, for instance, in the Shakespeare Code, Martha brings up how her skin colour may be a problem in the time period she's in.
Mm.
And in that way, it manages to address racism without doing the whole story about racism, but in a way that it doesn't feel shoehorned in, it feels natural. Whereas the absence of women in this feels completely unnatural because Robert Holmes has just gone, oh yes, let's have this setting without, as you say, Nathan, updating it and fixing the problems. Another problem I have with the story is that each episode seems to be part of a completely different story. So the first episode is a political thriller. The second episode is a police procedural.
Mm-hmm.
So they're collecting the evidence, slightly data. There are some lovely moments in there, and the Doctor gets to be a bit Sherlock Holmes, you know. I can feel my hair curling. So either I'm getting an idea or it's about to rain. There's little charming moments in there. We come to the third episode, which is the episode set almost entirely inside The Matrix, which is a real love it or hate it episode. So I'm just going to give you a few statistics about this. First of all, it was, I believe, the highest rated episode of the story, about 13 million viewers. Secondly, there are approximately 54 lines of dialogue in the episode, roughly 2 lines every minute.
Yeah.
That is how little dialogue there is in this episode. That is how thin the script is. And finally, the various guises of Goth that attack the Doctor in the Matrix, so the samurai, the clown, etc., were actually played by Bernard Horsfall.
Was the clown Bernard Horsfall?
The clown was Bernard Horsfall. He says, you know, I remember getting made up and laughing into the camera. That was very good. Todd, was I right about the ratings?
You were, but I often judge an episode on the episode after.
Yes.
Because that's the impact. And 1.2 million less viewers
tuned in next week. I'm ambivalent about it. I'm not love it or hate it. I think it's a really, really bold decision to... Because you think of this story and you think it's a studio-bound story set on Gallifrey, but in fact, you know, nearly one whole episode is on location. Having a virtual world created inside a computer network is... cyberpunk, you know, I mean, it's really early for that idea to even exist.
Yeah, the problem is, though, you just end up in a quarry and
I know, it's a quarry and a park. But you know, it looks realer than the stuff set in the real world.
Yeah,
because it's
film,
because it's on location, because the Doctor's being attacked by things, identifiable things from the 20th century or from Earth.
Yeah.
I think it's too violent. I think it's incredibly misjudged. Mm. So the Doctor gets shot twice. He tries to blow up Chancellor Goth with a grenade and seriously injures him. He poisons Goth. Goth catches fire. He hits him with a stick. And then there's that notorious episode 3 cliffhanger.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've seen more than 30 years in the TARDIS, you know Mary Whitehouse from the Clean Up National TV.
I can still see it in my mind's eye.
Yes. Yeah, she... and you know, she campaigned against the show in the Hinchcliffe era.
Mm.
And, like, am I wrong in my memories of the history here that when... Like, Hinchcliffe gets moved off it onto Target.
And, yeah, correct. That was part of the reason.
And Graham... That's part of the reason.
Mm.
Graham Williams comes on. He's told to tone the violence down.
Yeah.
And Hinchcliffe, in just a massive middle finger to his successor, just blows the budget completely on this season, and particularly on Talons of Wang Chiang. Yeah. And so this story, it's a pivotal point in the history of the show, not because of the Time Lords, because who cares? And we're better off without them, they're terrible. But in just the direction that the show takes, the yeah. fact that the budget collapses and the show stops being scary, and then eventually, like, I think that there's a line, a terrible, terrible line from here to the eventual cancellation of the show. And I think that Hinchcliffe and Holmes, who have been skirting with being irresponsibly violent for a while, just go over the line here.
Yeah, yeah. And the violence is just so bizarre, because we've been told that this matrix that they're in, it can create things from your thoughts. And the Doctor has been built up over the 70s as having these immense mental faculties. You know, he can survive psychic assaults. There's the mind-bending contest in Morbius, etc., etc., etc. But he has no power in this area, and he has to resort to brute force. And I think that's a huge, huge weakening of the character. And it's not really addressed.
I think the brute force is the mental... Do you know what I mean? Like, I think that what we're seeing is the mental battle between Goth and the Doctor, but that it's played out in these physical terms. You know, yeah, that's the form it takes. It's a little bit like Omega.
It's played out very crudely, though.
Yeah.
That's the thing. The Doctor doesn't attempt to capture or incapacitate Goth. He doesn't attempt to nullify the threat. He attempts to remove the threat.
Doesn't Goth create this reality? Isn't he in charge of it?
Yeah.
Well, from what the dialogue says.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
Now, this is where I have a problem with this. I didn't see
this. This is where you have a problem with this story.
You do not get to tell someone they can't like things, Nathan.
When have I ever accused a story of being tiresome?
Todd.
This is tiresome. This is tiresome because I come to it from a Star Trek perspective, having watched Star Treks where they have these people go into these fake realities that are all in their mind, and you watch the whole episode and then it's not real. And yeah. I loathe it to bits.
Yes.
At this point in time, if you are a fan in the UK watching this, this is revolutionary.
Yeah.
But that's not my perspective. What we get is we get over an episode of, well, it's not really happening, right?
Mm.
With all these horrible events happening, Goth is supposed to be in charge, right? It's supposed to be his reality. He spends three quarters of an episode masked, and then the Doctor goes, oh, tell me who you really are. So he decides, oh, yes, I'll tell you that I'm Goth, right? Up to that point, he is superhuman. Then the moment, science fiction cliche, that you unmask that superhuman thing, then they're suddenly vulnerable. You know, he's creating this reality. Well, I'm going to leave the grenades here. If it's my reality, maybe I should just make them disappear. When I pour the poison glass of jar into the creek, surely I would make that disappear, right?
Yeah.
Not leave it there for the Doctor to find. And then, you know, when I do get injured, surely I could just, you know, we'll just get rid of that wall over there on the left, and I'll create some special medical device to heal myself. It's all this stuff that just drives me absolutely mad. And by the end of this episode, I am so irritated with this show.
Yeah.
And that is why this is my least favourite story of the season.
Mm. Right.
It's not how the Time Lords work. It's this. And there's all this techno babble to set up the Matrix, the data extracts things that they go on with. And I'm just there going, oh.
And yeah, you know what? Much later in the show, we get Christopher Bidmead, who's accused of taking the magic out of Doctor Who. This takes so much magic out of it. The Doctor, our magical man in the box, says that brainwaves are just electrochemical impulses. The Doctor reduces the soul to science. Now, I am not a religious person. I'm not really a spiritual person. But I don't think that the Doctor should be defining that. And then we get all this scientific explanation of how the Matrix works. The Doctor is a character who has managed to defeat Omega, the most mentally powerful Time Lord in existence, who has a whole universe at his disposal. And yet, the best he can do against Goth is try and blow him up with a grenade. It's like, ugh. It just feels so wrong for the character. He's taking up arms. And on the one hand, you could say, oh, you know, it's the desperation of the situation. But the Doctor should always find another way. I put out there that the Doctor in the Matrix in this story is far more violent than anything Colin Baker's Doctor does.
I think this is the most violent the show's been. Mm. And look, I actually find that episode pretty entertaining, I have to say.
Oh, it's entertaining.
I quite like
Oh, look, there's entertaining
parts. Action-packed and stuff. You know, there's a lot going on.
But it just, all those reasons why I've said just begin to just mount up and irritate me. And even the choo-choo train that comes at the end of whatever episode it is, I kind of went, oh, big whoop. Big
yeah,
whoop.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because we know what's going to happen. It's just going to disappear. Because we know this is an illusory world.
I have problems with the Master's motivations in this. Why even get the Doctor involved? Up to this point in time, he's quite willing to, you know, want to take over the universe and, oh, if the Doctor dies, ha, ha, ha. But here, after, you know, he's completely mentally unhinged. It's a complete rewrite of the character.
Oh, I agree. And when he's described, particularly by the Doctor... You know, he's described as being thoroughly evil and the embodiment of evil. Well, that wasn't Delgado. Delgado used to have sword fights and eat sandwiches and stuff. He was lovely.
And back to what you were saying, this is going to influence the rest of the show and what poor Anthony Ainley has to go through in the 1980s.
Yes.
And, you know, even in the final sequences here where the Master actually shoots them all and knocks them out, well, surely at this point in time he's shrunk Hildred to nothing. Wouldn't he just kill them at that point? Like, it's just, to me, it's sort of like, you wanted to destroy them, but no, we're just going to stun them. Yeah. Really? Honestly? Mm.
And at least they don't prolong it and he just says immediately, no, they're just stunned. Like, we don't get to, we don't have to go, oh, you know, are they dead, you know?
Yeah, because he does the sort of 1930s Batman villain thing of going, you know, no, they're not dead because you're going to suffer when the planet explodes. And it's like, that's the whole reason he's called the Doctor back to Gallifrey. If the Doctor's premonition had been sent by the Matrix, which could have then been, the Doctor could have said, oh, maybe it's not just electrochemical impulses, maybe there is consciousness there. And, you know, that's science fiction and that's interesting. No, the Master's lured him back there in order to kill him. And that is what stops the Master with the fact he's lured the Doctor back there. So it's the stupidest the Master has ever been. You know, at least with Delgado.
I think the competition's pretty stiff.
Okay, yeah, it is, because Delgado used to get involved with these allies and then go, oh, you've betrayed me! Whereas in this case, the Master has gotten someone who he knows will betray him no matter what happens and just gone, oh yeah, come on over here so I can have some fun with you.
It's another one of these criminals from the past. It's another Hinge Holmes criminals from the past who's back for revenge. Mm. And we get the Doctor's exile mentioned and a few things that kind of hint to us that it's going to be the Master a bit later on. And I do like the reveal because Goth calls him Master and then we discover it's the Master.
Yeah.
You know, that's kind of fun. But he isn't the Master that we know at all.
It irritates me that the Master's sort of been erased from everything at the CIA's request. Like, to me, it's just sort of like, really? You're going to do that? Like,
honestly, I thought he got in and stole his files.
Yeah, that's what I thought as well.
You know, when he stole the Doomsday weapon file and all of that, he stole his own school reports and stuff, you know.
But then at the beginning it says, Gallifrey faces doesn't the biggest sort of crisis or whatever. And really, in the end, it's like two policemen, pseudo-companions, commander of the guard and a couple of people actually really do know what's going on, and the rest of Gallifrey is probably quite oblivious to the whole thing.
No, but a big black croton head came out of the floor and nearly destroyed the entire planet and the nearby star system. It was a giant crisis.
But is
no, but they're not aware of that until point. You know what I'm saying? Like, nobody's aware of it until, that happens, you know?
Yeah. But, they rewrite it, and there's that wonderful scene at the very end with Angus Mackay as Verusa trying to decide what the real story that they're going to tell.
Yeah. I mean, that's good.
That's terrific. Yeah. You know, all that Machiavellian politicking, which is just the sort of cynical thing that you employ Bob Holmes to do, I think.
Mm. I mean, I can see why at the time fans would say that this was, you know, cutting edge. It was like, you know, it was so different from anything else on television in terms of presentation and style. But I think that I'd love for those people out there who regard this as the be-all and end-all and really up there to go back and rewatch it after what we've said and realise that it ain't all that.
I like it more than you do, I think. But it is Bob Holmes. You know, he is funny. There's all sorts of reasons to dislike him, but he's a skilled writer. He writes funny dialogue.
I'll acknowledge that there's good dialogue, there's good performances. I can see what it's trying to do. It just, for me, is just not there.
Yeah, you know what? The design's great. The direction's great, the performances are great, the dialogue itself is great. the plot is complete bobbins. The greatest threat the Time Lords have ever faced in their history. Oh yeah, getting sucked into a black hole by your ancient god who gave you time travel. Nah, that's nothing.
Now, that happened three times that week. We didn't just see it on screen. My favourite bit, can I say, from the absolute climax is, as we said before, this terribly unimpressive thing comes out of the floor and the Master's manipulating it and the Doctor rushes in. And then the Master ends up running after the Doctor, hitting him with the sash of Rassilon. Fabulously camp way.
Yes.
It's terrific. Mm. It's the Master at his absolute best.
The one thing I do like about the Master in this, you know, I think Peter Pratt's voice is fine, as I mentioned before, but the one thing I really like is there's a line he gives which implies that his mania, if you like, his obsession with the Doctor is due to the fact that he has become so deformed. He says something to Goth like, you know, once I was like you, but now in this form. And that is the only way I can imagine, that's the only way I can accept that this is the Delgado Master, because he was urbane and suave and charming, and that is where most of his power came from, was his ability to influence. Take that away from him and yeah, it would lead to him being this sort of decrepit figure. I don't think it quite works, but
you might have to keep telling yourself that.
I think that was the active idea they were going for. I think they were acknowledging the past of the character. I don't think they do it enough.
What do you think about his sausage fingers?
The gloves are amazing. The mask, I think, could be a little bit smaller so it actually looks like a skull. But the sausage fingery gloves are very, very scary.
I think the ping pong ball eyes are terrifying.
Yeah.
So much more effective than Jeffrey Beavers. Right?
Jeffrey Beavers has a lovely voice as well.
Oh, no, I think it's a great performance.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong, but I think the ping pong ball eyes in this make it that much more terrifying.
Yeah. That weird final shot where you can kind of see through the Master's TARDIS clock face and there's this sort of weird face and it's kind of like, is it half regenerating or something?
Yeah,
that
looks really
off-putting. Maybe they're giving themselves the option of bringing him back regenerated, but they just don't go anywhere.
I hope they don't. Yeah. I hope this is the last we see of the Master.
I agree as well.
When I watch this story, I never think that he's regenerating, but I know that some people out there do.
There's something weird looking about him in
He's kind of... He's kind of a bit more fleshy, isn't he?
Yeah.
Maybe he's stolen Goth's face.
Ew.
I really didn't want to just trash this story, and that's what I've done.
You secretly like it. It's like me and the Massacre. I watch it once a week.
Right, well, dear listener, that's all the time we have for The Deadly Assassin. Next week, I'm going to be taking us down a forest path where we meet our new companion, Leela, as played by Louise Jameson in The Face of Evil.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Little Red Riding Hood.
Until then, do check us out online, flightthroughentirety.com, flightthroughentirety on Facebook and iTunes, and FTE Podcast on Twitter. Also available on Bondfinger at the moment. We have commentaries for Dr. No and From Russia With Love, and next Saturday you'll be able to get the classic Sean Connery James Bond film Goldfinger on there as well. You'll also find Bondfinger on Facebook and Bondfingercast on Twitter. Until then, may all your fingers not be sausage ones. Good night.
Good night.
See you soon.
That was Flight Through Entirety with Todd Bealby, Nathan Bottomley and Brendan Jones. This episode, A Hooker in the TARDIS, was recorded on Sunday, the 2nd of August. The next episode will be released on October 4th, 2015. I do try not to flux wither or change my state, but I accidentally bought Bovril instead of Botox.
It should have stuff about like trade embargoes and stuff. Taxation of trade routes to outlying star systems. Oh wait, let me put everything on airplane mode.
Oh god, I haven't done that either. I'd hate for us to be interrupted.
My watch, my phone, my pacemaker.